Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J, and for the next half hour, I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. So keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left. I'm speaking today with Steve Kurtz. Steve is one of the principal activists and artists within the Critical Art Ensemble. Welcome, Steve.
Thanks very much for having me.
Now, the Critical Art Ensemble has engaged in a number of different interventions and participatory and performance art projects over the years. But tell us, what was the origins of the Critical Art Ensemble?
Well, I always wish there was some heroic story, but unfortunately there's not. We were just dissatisfied students that got together and decided we were going to make our own pedagogical program in terms of the arts and sciences.
So art students where?
We were all at Florida State University at the time.
And now you're different faculty at different places?
Well, actually, I'm the only faculty. The rest of us, you know, we all just have kind of regular jobs. One runs a multimedia studio, one works in a bookbindery, one was an editor.
The work that the Critical Art Ensemble has done can be found, by the way, at critical-art.net. So those of you who are listening online can go there and check it out while we're talking. For a number of years, I guess since the mid-90s, the focus of CAE, or one of the major focuses, has been on biotechnology and genetic engineering and things like that. How did that interest come about?
Well, where we originally started for perhaps almost the first 10 years of the group, where we were really interested in information and communication technology, and particularly in trying to undermine this libertarian utopian rhetoric that had attached itself to things like the personal computer and such like.
The California ideology.
The California ideology, that's it exactly. So we had a great stake in trying to do away with that. But around 1996, I think that project had been fairly well accomplished. I mean, obviously, we'll never get rid of utopian rhetoric, but skepticism was everywhere. I mean, all the festivals we would go to and conferences and such like, the California ideology was definitely looked upon with a raised eyebrow. And we also felt like, you know, the computer was really becoming part of everyday life, that the openness of it that was originally there, because not that many people had jumped on the bandwagon yet. You know, these gaps were being closed up and laws were being formalized and rules and protocols formalized. And so we were just kind of looking to where did we think the next kind of more or less free-for-all in regard to technology would be. And we started looking into biotechnology and the life sciences, and it became clear very quickly that if you're talking about a complete switch in the paradigm of genomics, that here was the place, that the political implications were going to be vast and large, and they didn't seem to really be spoken about that much. So we thought it's time for critique and action, a combination of the two, to infiltrate that discourse.
I think one of the first times I ran across the work of CAE was when someone ran across the Biocom website, a firm that that you invented, a biotechnology firm that one of the slogans of is to create better platforms for human labor or something, to create the new worker.
Right.
And they emailed it to me and thought that it was real. I'm sure that's not the first time that's happened with you guys. And we're so excited about it. One of the techno-utopians that we're talking about. And recently there was the movie The Island, which is about a cloning firm that, you know, raises human beings and then kills them, you know, because they're clones of their originals. And the firm that's involved in that was Merck Biotech, and they did the same thing. They created a website, Merck Biotech website, that you can find online that looked extremely realistic and had all these wonderful flash graphics. But you'd
right.
done it 10 years before they did. So,
yeah.
So how was the Biocom website and project instantiated? What kinds of interventions did you do with that?
Well, you know, this was, for us, was trying to get a conversation going, a critical conversation going, regarding new reproductive technologies. because while they could have a utopian aspect to us, there really seemed to be a resurgence. It was hidden in the rhetoric, but they're all the same, a resurgence of eugenics speak. And that's what really concerned us, was, you know, not only would they bring back this rhetoric, but that people would pay to engage it. And this we found a little bit bothersome. So we wanted to say, okay, well, let's let everyone engage this and see what kind of social situation emerges. So we would go as Biocom, and we would give people real tests to see if they were genetically suitable for reproduction. In other words, could they really be used in the market for eggs and sperm? And as you would guess, I mean, a grand majority of people would not be acceptable. I mean, just by going through their paperwork alone of looking at, you know, various kinds of disease histories that were in their families and such like, they would be rejected very quickly. And as the piece goes on, for those who were accepted, for those that get by their test, you know, we would go further and we would take a blood sample from them from which we'd extract the DNA, and we would take their photo and we would take cell samples for cryogenic preservation. And this two-tiered system emerged very quickly, and it was, even though people knew this was a performance, it was still rather upsetting and caused quite a bit of uproar in it. And we would just go around to different places doing it.
So you didn't do this on a guerrilla basis. You didn't go and set up in a mall and pretend that you were doing this for real. You were in a performance spaces.
We were this one was way too complicated. I mean, you know, we had like, you know, we had to have doctors and nurses, and we had laboratories there because we were doing the DNA extraction on site. So that there was also this interaction between medical professionals and science professionals and those that would show up. So it was quite costly to mount. You couldn't do something like this guerrilla style. It was too big a production.
Now, you mentioned the eugenics. I'm sure you're aware of the Center for Genetics and Society out in California, Oakland. And they've been campaigning for years against techno-eugenics and see many of these reproductive technologies as leading to that scenario. But I had recently Nicholas Agar on. He's a New Zealand philosopher. He's recently wrote a book called Liberal Eugenics, where he and many others argue that there's a significant philosophic distinction to be made between parents making choices that they think are in their children's best interests, often about reducing their disease potentials, expanding their abilities, or parents just making decisions about what kind of children that they want to have for aesthetic reasons, and the state mandating some kind of decision, that, you know, a distinction based on authoritarianism, mm-hmm. and an individual choice. You kind of elide that distinction with this project.
Oh yeah, I don't believe that at all. I mean, what we were trying to argue, and you know, you started is it's making a better worker one platform at a time, making a better organic platform. That what the parents are choosing is what they've internalized within the system. And what they've internalized is capitalist values, is the first thing. So what they're choosing, they're not choosing kids that, well, this would be a more empathetic child, or, you know, this would be a more loving child. They're choosing things like, is it better stamina? You know, and if you look at these tests that they use to choose what are the appropriate materials to harvest, these questions have to do with, one, making a better worker, and two, making a prettier person. That's what they have to do with. And certainly when someone goes and is trying to make decisions for their kids beyond health, I think you're in a completely different place. And it's about values that you've internalized. It's not like a wide range of choice you're given. You know, the market has already dictated something, and the consumer is kind of a feedback machine. So those two things are important to remember, is that, you know, we do internalize the values that we're brought up with, and those values are reflected within the screening tests that are being used. To think that they are value-free or neutral, or that they're not directional in any way, I mean, that's completely naive. So, you know, the liberal eugenics position, I'm fairly skeptical of.
Well, the other projects that we'll talk about in a second, the Cult of the New Eve and Genterra and some of the other projects,
right,
reflect a similar kind of what my colleagues and I refer to as bioconservative notion or bioconservative critique. But you also have this project, the Society for Reproductive Anachronisms.
Right.
Which it says was, which is a website as if there's this organization out there that you have actually created, and it says it's to combat the rationalization and instrumentalization of the reproductive process that is occurring in order to totally manage its service to the pan-capitalist order. And it seemed like that particular project was more a poke at the left-wing bioconservative arguments that, you know, that you were kind of making fun of and making an extreme parody of them with this project.
Yeah, well, we were making fun of a lot of people. I mean, the way the SRA came up was directly linked to Flesh Machine, to the first project we were talking about, Biocom. Was, like I said, we couldn't do that everywhere. We had to have really, you know, sponsors with deep pockets. So we wanted to create another way where we could do it, as you were talking about earlier, guerrilla styles. We could just go to universities and to malls and wherever we want and have this discussion. But we were kind of of the opinion, well, you know, if we do it just regarding reproductive rights, we're probably not going to get that much play. We need something more attractive. And so we constructed the SRA, which is, you know, this incredibly, as you pointed out, ridiculously sex positive, naturalized reproductive rights people. And yeah, so there's a parody, I think, in that one that kind of goes across the board, that, you know, we're hitting both sides. I mean, while we're making fun of the SRA's position and having fun with that, there also is the critique of the conservatives going on that is precisely serious. And kind of in that fun sphere, that's, you know, a sphere of entertainment for sure, we can pass these ideas more easily.
Well, it seems like you're recognizing partly with that project that there is around the edges of a critique of the use of reproductive technologies, the potential for the closing down of reproductive choice and to reinforce conservative critiques of reproductive choice in general. In, recently in India, the Indian Medical Association, in response to the ubiquity of sex selection, suggested that women should not have access to ultrasound for any reason because it was so difficult to control how they were going to use it. And that,
right,
you know, that seems like a pretty scary direction to go.
Yeah, and you know, you're not going to get any disagreement with me on that one. And this is a really interesting area of pointing out, is when the arguments on all sides seem compelling, right? That it's like, oh boy, you know, that there's not really a way to win that. But in the end, of course, something like ultrasound and proper prenatal care for the mother, I think, in the end, is going to always be victorious. But, you know, but there's always that other side that it's definitely not without consequences because of, you know, the problem of sex selection and what goes along with that is, in India especially, indeed a serious problem, you know, kind of leaving babies in the garbage can after they're born because they're not the right sex. Problem.
Right, so, but sex selection before birth actually takes care of that problem.
What's that?
Sex selection before birth actually takes care of the problem you just mentioned, right? It doesn't encourage that problem. It gets rid of that problem. I'm speaking with Steve Kurtz. He's the one of the principals of the Critical Art Ensemble, and we'll talk in a second about the Critical Art Ensemble Defense Fund, which is another project that has now emerged out of the Critical Art Ensemble. But finish up with some of the reproductive technology and biotech interventions that that the CAE has engaged in. Another one that seemed to be a shot across the bow of many of the enthusiasts was the Cult of the New Eve, which was an effort to, I take it, to go out and pretend as if there was a group that really believed in a new biotech, you know, that we're creating a new humanity through biotech.
Yeah, the Cult of the New Eve, what we were really after there was to show how much of a sideshow often goes along with science. So we went and got quotes from leading scientists, and they were mainly ones who in some way were trying to hawk their startup company or were trying to pull down big grants. And where it started was we had gone to a lecture by Lee Hood, a very, you know, significant person in the Human Genome Project, And he started his lecture with the sentence, "I am going to make you all immortal." I was like, man, these guys are getting carried away with themselves. So we started looking into this, and some of these sales pitches were just unbelievable. And we thought, well, I guess when scientists say them, they can kind of get away with it because they are these kind of grand poobahs of scientific knowledge. But what would happen if we said these exact same things, but from the most disbelieved social formation that's out there, a cult? Then how would the public react to it? And so that's what we went about doing. And watching this moment of dissonance, as we would say, look, this is what the leading scientist says. We're just repeating it to you. But at the same time, looking at these cult figures all dressed alike in their little sunglasses and, you know, worshiping the new Eve. How are they going to react to that? How are they going to balance it out?
Were you aware of the Raelians when you did the project?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. In fact, people asked us if we had any relation to them.
You were like a Raelian offshoot or something.
Yeah.
Yeah, I recently met a Raelian, and you know, it is amazing because they're avowedly atheist, avowedly scientific, secular, mm-hmm. and all this. And then, you know, you get around to the UFO part of it, and suddenly it goes off in the supernatural direction. But in almost everything else, they're techno, you know, utopians. So, and just like all the secular folks that you're mentioning.
Well, yeah, we had a great deal of fun with the Cult of the New Eve project. And that one was, we had that really designed on a sliding scale so it could be like a mammoth, expensive, monumental project, or it could just be a small guerrilla thing that we did in the streets. That one worked all kinds of ways. But the fun part where I think we really outdid ourselves was in creating the beer and wafer that we would give as the New Eve communion, in which we got the original genome from the first person to donate to the Human Genome Project, who we called the New Eve. That's who we worshipped. And we took that DNA and made a random DNA libraries and brewer's yeast. And then we took that and we brewed beer and we made cookies with it. And so when we would initiate someone in, we would say, you know, you could go down to the street to the Catholic Church and get, you know, some wine and crackers and call that the body and blood of Christ. But when you come here and we say we're giving you the New Eve, we're really giving you the New Eve. You know, you're getting our full genome.
It's funny, but at the same time, there was a recent article that in order to increase the resistance to certain kinds of herbicides, they had discovered that there was a human protein which increased the resistance of rice to these herbicides, and they were going to introduce this human protein into the rice.
Right.
And people began to freak out in the press that this was the first step towards cannibalism, and you know, then they started to think about the transgenic pigs who had human immune systems and human organs and whatnot, and what the ethical consequences mm-hmm. were of eating transgenic crops and animals.
Right.
So, you know, these issues, they do kind of slide around that way.
Oh, well, we that's in the cult's website. We celebrate the cannibalism of New Eve when we're cult figures.
Well, your other three projects, the first three, Flesh Machine, Society for Reproductive Anachronisms, and Cult of the New Eve, which can all be seen at critical-art.net, by the way, those are about human reproductive technology. And
yes.
Then you focused more, I guess, in recent years on agricultural biotechnology.
Right.
With Genterra, Contestational Biology, and the Free Range Grain Project. So let's tell us a little bit about what those interventions were.
Well, that's where we started really getting into the politics of transgenics, right? I mean, that's what we realized in Cult of the New Eve, in doing that kind of ingest, just how serious this situation was as well, that this was, you know, another prong that we believed really needed investigation, and that was truly revolutionary. So like I said, we started looking into transgenics and tried to see if we could figure ways to separate out what were, you know, very well-engineered organisms versus those that were really little more than pollutants for profit. And to see also, such as with free-range grains, just how far this food trend had actually gone, whether or not it's possible anymore to eat non-GM food, especially if you're buying processed food of any kind. So, you know, we had these kind of interests as we went into that. And then finally, with contestational biology, or molecular invasion, as we like to call it, we were interested to see if we could take the strengths of some of these products, particularly Monsanto's products, because, you know, they just seemed like the most evil of all of these corporations and have a long history of environmental abuse. So we thought, I wonder if we could take their number one cash crop, Roundup Ready, and find a biochemical that could target the particular gene that modified the plant. So it would, you know, whatever we released out would only hurt that plant and nothing else. So that was kind of what that project was about, and to do public experimentations, right? Again, to bring labs out of the laboratory and into the public sphere where they can be demystified, and, you know, kind of the reifications that the public has often built up from watching too many episodes of X-Files could be taken away, and the reality of all of this put in its place.
I do encourage everyone to go take a look at those projects at critical-art.net. The websites are very flash and very attractive, very well done, and there's a very nice documentation of the various interventions and performances that were surrounding these projects. But I want to mention briefly, on a more sober note, a year ago your wife died. And in the context of your wife having died, the police came to your home and they discovered a lot of biological equipment that was in your home as a consequence of your doing these various projects. And you're not at liberty to talk about the details of the case. And so I'm going to give my thumbnail overview and people can read more about it at caedefensefund.org. But as a consequence of this investigation, you came to the attention of Homeland Security or the Attorney General's Office of New York, and now are still under investigation by the FBI, as I take it. So the more of these details are at the caedefensefund.org. And many people have rallied to your defense and the CAE's defense in general because they see this case, the fact that your objects are still impounded and that you are still under this shadow of investigation.
Well, it's more than investigation. I've been indicted for 2 counts of mail fraud and 2 counts of wire fraud.
Oh, okay. And they see this as real persecution of both critical engaged art out there and also an example of the kind of overreach of the Homeland Security Patriot Act environment that we live in. So you want to address some of that aspect of the case?
Well, it's a very long and complicated discussion of why this happens, because there are all different registries. Some are very concrete and some are very abstract as to why it's going on. Certainly, it's a politically motivated case. There's absolutely no doubt about it that, you know, an extremely well-known political artist such as myself and an extremely well-known geneticist who has kind of always refused military contracts, Bob Farrell, my co-defendant, and was also the chair of genetics at the University of Pittsburgh and housed his school in the School of Public Health, not in the biology department. You know, these are two prime targets to make examples out of. One of the reasons for doing it at the more abstract level is to intimidate the institutions of the fine arts and the sciences to say, look, you know, we used to, in the old days, back in the 60s or whatever, when people started talking about political economy in relation to these disciplines, we would just try to get them fired or have their grants pulled. But we want to let everyone know now that you're going to go to jail if you do this. Not only are we going to try and ruin your life, we're going to try and put you in jail as well. So there is this incredible intimidation factor that's going on, and it already has put quite a chill on universities in general. It's put a chill on distributors. Right now, for amateurs like myself, it's become incredibly difficult to get any kind of wetware to work with, right? Because the FBI has gone to them all, particularly the ones, the distributors I used to deal with, and say, you know, you can't do this anymore. Even though it's completely legal and there are no regulations in terms of any of the things that I was using, not one. Because of my case, it has become harder for everyone in terms of the life sciences and arts. if you're just over there saying, you know, we're going to make a nice piece about astronomy, or we're going to make a nice piece where we're going to make paintings using enzymes, that's fine. You know, you're not going to get in any, you're not going to get in any problem whatsoever for that. But when you start doing things of saying, well, you know, how can we invert Monsanto's sabotage techniques against traditional and organic farmers, that's where you get in trouble, right? There's a big distinction there between those of us who are looking at this critically and those of us who are simply looking at it aesthetically.
You've had a number of campaigns, a number of events around the country to raise money for the CAE Defense Fund. How's that going? Do you have adequate funds to mount your defense?
Yeah, it was touch and go because for the first 9 months or so, I mean, we were just making it. I was running from fundraiser to fundraiser, and we were getting the bills paid. But finally, the New York and L.A. art scenes really rallied. And, you know, kind of had heard about the case and thought enough is enough of this. And they did an auction, and we raised like $170,000. So overall, we've raised around $250,000. So we're at the moment in pretty decent shape to fight this financially.
And are you guys still able to concentrate on making some art?
Yeah, we're still making work. It's a lot slower, as you might guess.
What are your current objects of focus?
Well, the current thing, and this is partly, again, what got us in trouble, was we were doing a project called Marching Plague, which was a critique of the government's germ warfare program, and particularly how it competes for resources with public and global health initiatives. So, you know, that's why we had a lot of the bacteria that we had here, which were all safe, benign bacteria, completely unregulated. You know, it's legal for any citizen to have them. But they were used as simulants by various germ warfare programs around the world. And so we were looking into how these simulants were used. Anyway, what in the end, the project was twofold that we were going to come out with. We're in the middle of writing a book, which was very difficult because the FBI took all our research. They took everything. They took my books. They took all my notes. You know, they definitely did not want this book to come out, which is part of the reason we've never gotten any of our stuff back. And the other thing that we were going to do was to recreate the insanity of the tests that they did for when they actually thought back in the 40s and 50s germ warfare could be useful. They know now that it can't. But the charade goes on, and the Bush administration is expanding the germ warfare program as fast as he can go. It's gone from a program that was in the millions to now one in the billions. And also Clinton deserves some credit for that as well. We don't want to leave him out.
Steve, we're coming to the end here, and I want to briefly plug again, critical-art.net and the CAE Defense with an S fund.org. For folks who want more information about this, I've been speaking with Steve Kurtz of the Critical Art Ensemble. We'll definitely have you back to check in on how the defense is going.
Yeah.
And after our my listenership, which generally is going to have quite a time with your websites once they trawl through them, we'll definitely have more to talk about later. So thanks so much for coming on today.
Oh, it was a pleasure.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts with me, Dr. J, you can contact me at jhughes@changesurfer.com. That's jhughes@changesurfer.com. Or you can read my Change Surfing columns at betterhumans.com or check out the collaborative Cyborg Democracy blog I participate in at cyborgdemocracy.net. Or you can read my new book, Citizen Cyborg. For more details about Citizen Cyborg, visit cyborgdemocracy.net. At the Change Surfer website, you can find past and future shows archived in streaming MP3, thanks to the AInfos radio project. So educate, agitate, and organize, and I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.